His work concerns issues of housing, health, employment, education, wealth and poverty. He's published with many colleagues more than a dozen books on issues related to social inequalities in Britain and several journal papers as well. One of his recent solo authored books is entitled Inequality and the 1%. Today, Professor Dawley will be talking about social, political, economic and health inequality and our grandchildren's future. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Professor Dawley.
Hey, thanks very much for inviting me. I am going to stop on time at 3 o'clock, otherwise my health will be damaged because I have to pick a child up from school. So I'm not rushing off no matter how critical you are what I'm about to say. And I'm not going to show you all these slides because there are too many of them. They come from a talk which I did at the Medical Sociology Conference a few weeks ago in York, and what I thought I'd do is actually take up Adam's challenge about London to try to explain the difference in approach between a clinical approach and a more sociological approach. In London, there's been this dramatic improvement in health in recent years, and it leads the improvement to mean that our life expectancy has gone up more than in similar countries. And so there's a conundrum, you know, why has life expectancy in the UK gone up faster than in places which were much the same? Well, we've had a pretty bad economic crash and so on, and living standards have dropped and inequalities have risen. Now, the answer does appear in the Lancet paper that appeared a few weeks ago with the enormous list of authors, but it's only one line in the Lancet paper as one possible explanation. So I thought the best way to try to explain a different way of thinking is to take a similar problem, which is led by London, and show the different approaches you could do for that. London's had one of the biggest improvements in secondary school exam results in the country in the last 15 years. 15 years ago, London state schools were amongst some of the worst in the country. They're the kind of state schools you would kill not to send your child to. That's not quite what Diane Abbott said, but it was like that. Now, the bottom 10% of London state schools produce better GCSE results than the whole of Norfolk and Suffolk. You know, these are the very worst inner city London schools. Children doing incredibly well at school, usually was going to university. Absolute miracle. You know, it's a policymaker's dream. And it's similar to the rise in life expectancy. Now, you could try to understand why education's improved so much in London by taking those GCSE results and dividing them by subject, English, maths, science, languages, and so on, and look at in which subjects have there been the biggest increase, and then could it be the teachers who are better in that subject, or could it be that children started reading books at home, so if you see a big increase in English GCSE, that's the cause of this. Now, English and maths, of course, are the big GCSE, so it's rather like cardiovascular disease and cancers. If you do that, if you try to understand the improvements in education in London by subdividing it almost clinically by academic subject, you'll get results, but they don't actually tell you what's happened in London. But of course teachers like it, because teachers specialise in particular subjects, and if you tell them all they've done very well, you know, it makes them happy. The Department for Education's best guess as to what's happened in London comes down to three things. Grudgingly, they do say a little bit of it was more spending by the previous government on London schools. Okay? It's hard to think there's a bit more spending can't have helped, particularly with the school buildings. The tragedy is that when you actually talk about improving school buildings in London, what you are talking about is building a big prison-like wall around the edge of a school, but at least making the school safe. So, a bit like the NHS, spending matters, but is not the key determinant. The second one is that London can get teachers. And that's very odd. But London can get teachers because teachers' partners can get jobs in London. In fact, London is, in many ways, often the only place teacher partners can get jobs. 90% of new full-time work in the last 10 years has been in London. So London can get teachers. It's not something you might have predicted. You'd have never thought with a rising housing market London could get teachers, but it can. And luckily, because they can only get small flats, they can't have kids. There's nothing better than keen young teachers who haven't got children themselves and worked for 10 years in London before going off. But that wasn't the most important one. You probably guessed what the most important one was. What was the thing that transformed the education of London, particularly in London? It's mass immigration. Unbelievable rates of immigration, the biggest immigration we've ever seen, between 2001 and 2011, including whole groups of people. You know, 500,000 people born in India, we didn't even notice because so many people born in Poland were coming in. The immigration has continued since 2011. The biggest figures ever came out on August the 28th of this year. The press managed not to report them until today because the little boy's body washed up on the beach in Turkey. And so the usual press stories about how terrible immigration is didn't come out. But London has transformed. People, incredibly fit, young people, mainly from the rest of Europe, with about 3 university degrees, have turned up in huge numbers. At the same time, people have been squeezed out of London, particularly those who are ill, particularly people who've got ill children, because they're the ones that the benefit cap knocks out. So you're squeezing out the less able and the sick, you're allowing in the able, and you get these kind of changes. And I think when you're looking at the life expectancy improvement in England, you have to look at the fact that we have had by far the biggest increase in population in Europe and the highest amount of immigration in recent years, primarily because Europe's had its worst crash since 1929, and this happened in the 1931 census. If you're a young European and nothing much is happening in Spain or Greece or France or wherever you are, you go to where you speak your second language, and everybody only has one second language. And Ireland wasn't doing very well. So anyway, it's an illustration of the differences between approaches. Now, obviously, you need both. The other difference is that sociological human geography approach, we tend to look for bad news, whereas the clinical approach looks much more for, you know, for the real advantage, of which there are many and they continue. But if you're a social scientist, you're on a kind of permanent, you know, like a shark trying to, you know, where is the worst news story in this? And it's a pity, because I think if social scientists did more about things that are getting better, you know, we wrote more about what happened in London schools, rather than trying to find the worst school and then talk about that, it would be better. Anyway, some points I'm going to make. We have got rapid social polarisation going on. So even though all these people have turned up in London, the gap between rich and poor parts of London is widening dramatically. I think it's 15,000 people were evicted from houses in London last year, it's 30,000 so far this year. There's a mass eviction going on of the poor. Same thing in Oxford is happening. So Oxford rehouses people in Birmingham now, if they present themselves as statutory homeless. This changes Oxford. This area, this part of Cowley, people are living 7 years longer than they ought to be for an area with a similar rate of poverty. And I think it's because it's actually so hard to get into a council house around here. We still need to explain the 30,000 rise in deaths of elderly women that's occurred in the last few years, 2013, 2014. You may not be aware, there's been a rise, there's been an absolute increase in mortality amongst women in their late 70s and 80s. It's still not being explained. This kind of thing hasn't happened for decades. It really is important. There are at least 10 possible explanations, which include, you know, bizarre ones like, are people coming back who were retirees in Malta and Crete? You know, and if you come back just before you die, you're going to show up in our death statistics. Or one of my favourite explanations, and this is a real rise in deaths amongst women that's occurred. It's a major public health issue in Britain if you care about elderly women. If you don't care about elderly women, it isn't. And I'm saying that cynically, but if it wasn't elderly women, I do think an absolute rise of 30,000 would have brought out a bit more interest. It is absolutely not due to smoking, because you do not get an immediate jump in death due to smoking. You get a gradual rise, but the cohort started smoking 25 years ago. It is certainly not due to flu. But it isn't necessarily due to things like home visits dropping, or the massive cut in pension credits, which has been shown in papers yet to be published, but they're getting through the journals now, to be correlated. It could be due to things like the 10% drop in our petrol consumption in 2009-10. This sounds really weird to you. We hit our greenhouse targets in 2009-10. We look brilliant. We stopped 10% of trips driving because people had less money. Why could that be linked to the deaths of elderly women living on their own? Well, think about the trips you take in a car and decide what 10% of miles you might not do next year. Could it involve that long distance trip to Torbay to meet your annual visit of that great aunt you really don't like very much? So it could be that elderly people just gave up the ghost a bit more. It's complicated. Because there isn't a nice, neat answer, clinicians tend not to look at it, but it does need to be looked at. I'm going to go on and show you something about anxiety and depression, which I think really matters. And I'll talk a little bit, you just about see that little graph down there. It's a graph of improvement in years of life lost over time, and you can see it's flattening out at 2013. There are lots of little graphs like this floating around, because the very latest data, the 2013-2014 mortality data, are showing the end of an improvement of health for a bit. Let's put it that way. Part of it's the rise in the elderly deaths. A little bit of it is that increase in overdoses that finally happened, that we were waiting a couple of years to actually see it, from heroin and so on. But it's happening, and if your main job is going to be working in public health for the next few years, you're going to have to explain why the improvement in health appears to have stalled very recently. And one great thing about doing geography is you're allowed to veer all over the place. Another thing that's going to matter very, very much for you is politics. Health is political. There are political decisions about what's the right thing to do, what's the right thing to invest in. Do people deserve some advice about how they can behave better about their own health? Do you worry about smoking, or do you allow people to sell cigarettes without plain packaging? Because you're reducing freedom if you stop people being able to make their cigarette packets look nice. Do you worry about the underlying causes of smoking? We're not trying to stop people smoke, but working out why do more people smoke in the poor parts of Britain as compared to poor parts of other countries. I've put this quote up because you need to understand the thinking of the people who are in charge, I think, to get an idea of what's going on. This was an ad lib at the end of the budget speech. Every single line in that speech is, strictly speaking, true, which is why there isn't a line about health, because you can't find a good line about health. But you have a set of people in power who really believe that their predecessors did absolutely wonderful things and they're going to do wonderful things again. And I think it's helpful to understand that's where we're at the moment. And they do want to leave a mark, because history really matters, and they want to be remembered for some things and not remembered for other things that they might have done in the past or not. Here's another quote from a different time. And the reason I'm showing you this is going to show you how similar these times are. This is John Maynard Keynes talking about how bad it was in 1930 that, you know, people were being pessimistic about the future. But if you just step back, things look pretty good. He was quite an optimist, was Keynes. Turned out he was actually largely right. Things did get much, much better in the 50s and 60s and 30s. But writing just after a crash, when living standards had plummeted, when mass unemployment was rising, was about to get worse and worse, got up to 14 million unemployed in the United States, I think by 1933, before they sacked the statisticians because they couldn't afford to keep them anymore. It shows you quite an optimistic stance. Now the reason for putting those two up is to introduce this graph. This is the inequality curve for the United Kingdom. It's a take of the top 1%. Around about 1920, the best off 1% took 20% of all income, leaving 80% for the other 99%. We along with every other rich country in the world, saw equality rise in the 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s to the 70s, till we got to the point of maximum equality, which was around about 1977, when the best off 1% took only 6% of all income, or 4% after tax. That's the equivalent of about £100,000. So the best off 1% were getting about £100,000 a year in the 70s. A doctor, a general practitioner, was in the best off 1% back then. There weren't that many people above them. They actually paid slightly more than some top bankers back in the 70s. Doctors' wages have doubled in real terms since then, but they've actually dropped down the rankings. So the 1% and half of the next 2% are above many GPs and other clinicians, which is why medics can't buy the same kind of houses medics used to buy, even though medics are paid much more than medics used to be, because the house prices have gone up faster, because there's a group of people, the group who have taken more and more back up to about 15%, who can afford to pay £2 million for houses in Oxford, which they couldn't do anymore. So that's your central curve, and it may be tipping now. Now is interesting. In hindsight, the time around 1918 was interesting, it tipped then. The time around the 1970s was interesting, possibly the time around now was interesting, and I'm afraid all the time in between. Didn't matter who won the election, the trend just carried on going the same way. You can't see the effects of different political parties on this graph. One common reaction to seeing that graph is to say it's the same everywhere. You know, inequality is rising in all rich countries. You know, it's a global phenomenon. Now, it did fall in all rich countries in exactly the same way. It did come down in the 1970s to be very low in the same way. But really interestingly, we got a nice natural experiment. In some countries, it hasn't risen very much since the 70s. In some, like Switzerland and the Netherlands, it's actually still falling, and it fell from then. So we have a huge range of inequalities. I'll just show you these, and then I'll show you a couple of outcome graphs, and then I'll stop, and you can ask me some questions. This is the income inequality league table for the richest 25 countries in the world, produced about 5 years ago. The most equal country, these are countries with at least 2 million people and a high GDP. The most equal is Japan. Japan, fascinating public health experiment, was one of the most unequal countries in the world in the 1930s. The Americans invaded after dropping an atomic bomb, and because the Americans were afraid that there'd be a revolution in Japan, they took the land and distributed it as equal as they could amongst the population and destroyed the aristocracy. There was no revolution in Japan, and Japan went from having one of the lowest life expectancies in the rich world to now having one of the highest and having a 90% middle class. It's one of Michael Marlowe's early papers is trying to explain Japan. Anyway, Japan's there and is understudied. Then neatly lined up, Finland, Norway and Sweden, which I'm sure you've heard too much about, if that helped, and a bit of drinking in Finland. And then Germany, Austria, Slovenia, Denmark, Belgium. These are the equal countries. Switzerland's there, not massively unequal. And next, as we head up the inequality stakes, France, Netherlands, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy. Eventually get to the English-speaking ones. So you've got New Zealand, Australia, and then Israel. The number there is the ratio of the income of the best off 10th to the worst off 10th of the population. So the best off 10th for people living in Israel get about, or did get 5 years ago, 13 times more than the poorest 10th. There's huge differences. And it might seem unbelievable it can be that big. It's driven by the 1%. So if you think, you know, a general practitioner living with a registrar, household income, I'll let you work it out. It's all very English, we don't talk about these things. anyway, and people of similar social background tend to marry each other, to go out with each other. Now, so you're looking at two of those incomes. Anybody want to guess at the median income of people who work in Oxford? The median? That's the mean. The mean's 27. So the change you're quite near. So the median's lower. This is people in work.
I think it's
21. It's 21. Right, so the middle worker. But then, of course, you've got all the people not working in Oxford. Right? So as soon as you go to the median family in Oxford, and then think about a couple of medics living together, these gulfs are not... And remember, the medics don't include people in the 1%. Anyway, I can go on about this kind of thing too long. There's Israel. And there we are, slightly more unequal than Israel. Now, Israel is a very divided country for reasons that you are almost certainly aware of, so it's a bit of a shock to see that we have bigger divides. Portugal is more divided than us. That's now gone. This is 5 years out. House prices halve in Lisbon. That only hurts people who actually own property in Lisbon. United States is more equal than Singapore. It's a fascinating. So you have to look at Singapore if you want to see what a more unequal Britain might look like in terms of health. And I'll just tell you, I mean, a really good health outcome for Singapore is it has the lowest child mortality rate in the world. The kind of bad health outcome, or the reason that people in Singapore don't shout about the fact they've got the lowest child mortality rate in the world, is that they have 100,000 servants, these are maids, they're female, they're pregnancy tested. It used to be every 6 months, and now pregnancy tested every 3 months, and if you're pregnant, you're deported. So if you want to get your infant mortality rate really low, pregnancy test your guest labour and deport them before they can have a child. It might sound far-fetched, but Nicholas Soames, who was government minister a few years ago, suggested that when we leave Europe, when that vote is coming up, we should have a guest worker scheme to allow young Europeans in, because somebody's got to change the beds in the hotels. But they shouldn't be allowed to have children here. And so you can see this is wide ranging. Let's zoom right through just to a few outcomes, or possible outcomes. Now you've got to remember that in many ways things are getting much better. So we then tend to move on to the thing which isn't getting better. But it's only by constantly refocusing on what is the thing we should worry about most that we improve it. So the Global Burden of Disease Programme, the international one, has done a brilliant job of highlighting that deaths due to cars are enormous worldwide, much, much bigger in poor countries than in rich countries now. Still the biggest single modal killer of people between 5 and 24 here, because clinicians divide up things up into many causes. That cars beat them. But the projections are that car deaths are going to rise worldwide and very soon overtake AIDS, and you've got a pandemic of deaths from cars. Because the Global Burden of Disease Programme has shone the light on that, there is a slightly higher chance of some countries who are about to get many more cars thinking maybe it's a good idea if we look at ways in which we're not going to get so many cars. I'll talk about cars at the end, but as we're on the site of a former car factory. this is rising rates of anxiety amongst 15-year-old girls in North America over time. And it's in that the book called Injustice that I put the slide up at the very beginning about. And it comes from a paper, not written by me, written by a set of psychiatrists, I think, who are trying to show there is no rise over time in anxiety amongst young girls. What I did is take out all the studies which weren't in North America, because all the Scandinavian and Japanese studies were more recent. Girls appear to be happier or calmer there. If you take them out, you find a rise over time. Ben Goldacre doesn't like this graph, but I think it's still valid. Is to define daily doses of Prozac and equivalent. Antidepressants being taken in Scotland, you're looking at about a tenth of the adult population. It is an enormous rate of self-medicating. There are international studies to compare rates of mental health in different countries. We come out particularly badly. The US comes out worse, and if you look inside the US, it's actually the more affluent areas of the US which appear to be doing particularly badly for mental health. My penultimate graph, so I said I'd talk about cars, and this is strongly related to public health. There's been lots of arguments saying, you know, as a director of public health, you can put in a lot of effort to try to get statins put out and distributed amongst your population, and you can work out the effects of getting, and then it gets a bit controversial, somebody goes and publishes a paper saying they're not, you know, then there's a great big argument in medical literature about statins. But you can have a bigger effect by arguing for your city to be a 20 mile an hour city rather than a 30 mile an hour city. Not just on terms of the accidents and the killings that you stop, they're relatively small. In terms of getting more people to exercise and go out and walk and bike and not drive around. This is another one of these correlations. It doesn't mean that that causes that. It almost certainly means that something else is involved in both things. And on the bottom, you've got the take of the best off 1%, which is very high in the USA and it's very low in the Netherlands. So more unequal countries away from me, sorry, near me, more equal away from me. And on the y-axis, you've got the proportion of people who are walking and cycling to work. And it's every country for which there is data. You know, we don't, well, the way to lose your reputation, you know, as academic is to cherry pick your data in this game. Doesn't work for smoking and drinking, by the way. Smoking and drinking are quite individual things. It's really interesting. People smoke and drink like anything in Japan, but live for a long time. And France, I'll just leave it with, you know, it's a kind of untalked about sign of international health comparisons. The thing about smoking and drinking is you can just choose to do it on your own. You could, well, in Japan, in theory, you're supposed to let the other person pour the drink for you, but you know, you can get the bottle and drink on your own. You cannot choose to build a cycle path on your own. Although there are a few maverick people in Oxford who have tried to do this. You cannot, on your own, decide that you're going to not have a big building here with lots of different things going on called Unipart House, which everybody has to drive to around the ring road, but instead you'll arrange things so that people don't have to drive to get to work here. You'll have it as smaller units. You cannot do that on your own. But in countries like Denmark and Sweden and the Netherlands and Norway and to an extent France, they have decided over decades to plan their cities in such a way that they don't become reliant on a car. Why does this matter? It's not just McDonald's burgers that make you fat. It's sitting in a car for 3 hours commuting. It's a really good way not to exercise. The more people you've got commuting, the better. Let me just end with one political one, because it fascinates me, but it fits that inequality curve. And I think it shows what interesting times we're in. This is a segregation index. So a segregation index is a measure. They're normally used for working out the difference between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. How mixed are they? It's how many people would you have to move, say, from the Catholic areas to the Protestant areas to have no segregation between Catholics and Protestants. But in this case, I've taken Conservative voters and worked out the minimum number of Conservative voters you'd have to move in the right direction to get an even spread of Conservative voters at each general election from 1918 through to May 2015. So it's not about who wins the election, it's about how concentrated the vote is. Now the two things are related. You want your vote to be a bit concentrated, otherwise you're like the Green Party and you win one seat. You don't want your vote to be too concentrated, otherwise you win massively in the seats you're in, but you don't win the others. Conservative votes spread out across the country. In that same period as inequality declined, you can find Conservative voters everywhere. Had a lot to do with religion and being Protestant in Liverpool and that kind of thing. But anyway, we reached a high point of equality in the 1970s. 1974 election was key. The South East of England rejected the Labour Party in 1974. Didn't win the election for them, but that's the point. And then you have rising polarisation in the Conservative vote ever after. Meaning that where we are now, Oxford East looks like a pig village, 50% Labour vote. You've got to go somewhere in County Durham to find that. You know, so you know the polite conversation that you have in the cafes if you live where I live in Oxford East. Meanwhile, the county seats more and more and more conservative. So again, you know the right sort of thing to say to a random neighbour if you live there. The country is polarising between rich areas and poor areas, between different areas of voting. The amazing thing is what's happened in 2015. Huge leap in polarisation of the Conservative vote. Has nothing to do with Scotland, because there were practically no Conservative voters in Scotland anyway. There haven't been for many years. So it wasn't about that. It was the vote in Surrey and the counties going up and so on. So you might think, how on earth do they win the election? Because it's really inefficient having your vote increase where you're already holding seats. They won it because of the most amazing distribution between the other parties. Just perfect to win it. And the other parties really did themselves out. Now, the last way of illustrating this is, of the electorate, only one in four of the electorate voted Conservative. There's never been an election in history, as far as I can work out, where a lower proportion of people have voted and got a government. Certainly not in Britain, but even in the States, which have unprecedentedly low turnouts, the president has to get 26 or 27% of the vote to become president. Only one in four people voted for this government. This government didn't expect to be in. When people tell you they're in for 5 or 10 or 15 years, and it matters for health, it doesn't fit with that only one in four statistic. But the rest is all a mess. All these things are collected. Politics is connected to health, is connected to transport, is connected to your housing system, is connected to how you educate people, is connected to what kind of a house you can get in Oxford, or whether you have to think about living outside of Oxford because you can't actually buy the house even if you've done very well at university. That's the nice thing about doing geography, you can see the connections. The disadvantage of doing geography is that you end up doing everything at a fairly superficial level and walking into lines then of people who know far more about whatever it is you're talking about at any one time. But please ask me a question if you want to. Thank you.
Are there any questions at all?
Smoking has sort of lead time of 30 years before you see the health impact. How is that for social polarisation? You simply make a direct correlation on the day of today and see the impact. I thought that social polarisation shows only everybody in certain health aspects only 5 to 10 years later.
For infant mortality, you would expect a great lag. Not just for the infants, but even the effects on parents about to become babies, it should be fairly immediate things that have occurred. And there's a very strong correlation between infant mortality and inequality between rich countries, apart from Singapore. For life expectancy has the weakest correlation of bad things with inequality of all the bad things we measure. So there are obviously many more things affecting life expectancy in the society level. The biggie in the 1930s was mass unemployment. Mass unemployment is absolutely detrimental to life expectancy. It doesn't matter whether you're equal or unequal, and you could see an effect of that. There have been a couple of studies published that try to look at the very long-term lag effect of living at different times. So, my grandmother was born in 1916. In effect, would have entered the labour market in the 1930s, which you might think would be bad. But in fact, it was a middle-aged mass unemployment, so it wasn't bad for his cohort. Ends up in that post-war 1940, 50, 60 period, and benefits usually from that and ends up dying in his 90s. And you can show much stronger correlations between economic inequality and health if you take it into account those lags. So you get a generation who benefited from better chances in their youth. Jobs that were just hanging off trees. Everybody could get a job. And you see effects later. But of course, he was also the generation who were told in their 50s that cigarettes were bad for them. And they stopped. the vast majority of people stopped. If they hadn't been told, they wouldn't have stopped, and you wouldn't have seen that improvement. But it's a very tangential thing, the relationship between life expectancy and health outcomes and economic inequalities.
So why do you make a direct correlation then between more deprived being squeezed out of London and the life expectancy?
Oh, okay. You know, that isn't, that almost isn't an inequality one, because that's an improved inequality.
Nevertheless, you make a direct correlation.
One of the ways in which you get housed in Oxford is if you have enough medical points to score for council housing. But if Oxford no longer builds any council houses, it's finally building 40 in Barton West, and if the council houses it has are being sold off under the right to buy, then it doesn't matter if you've got those. Our housing system is directly related to health in that way. We have a healthy migrant effect. People who end up in this city, who manage to get here and manage to stay here, are doing very, very well in life. And even then, and it's kind of the level just below people working in medicine, teachers. The vast majority of teachers in Oxford leave at around about age 27, because unless you've got family money, you have to carry on renting, and all your wage as a teacher goes on rent and food. So you end up, you have a, it's a brilliant way of sorting people, is migration. And the harder you make it, the more differential. It's like passing exams, but it's much harder than passing exams. Because you can teach people how to pass exams, and you can train them for the test. Whereas making a migrant journey is hard work. Any of you who've moved from one city to another know it's a bit hard. The further the move is, you jump across international borders, it's even more selective. You have to be braver, you're more different. So all the studies of health effects find that migrants tend to be healthier. And the most selective of all is telling people that their migration is illegal. You know, if you really want to get a set of people with an enormous amount of get up and go, it's the Syrian middle class. And where the Syrian middle class end up, it's going to be rather like Ugandan Asians in the 1970s. These things just, they scream out of the data, the migrants. The other area is losing. So Glasgow lost half its population over 40 years. What half did it lose? Who left Glasgow? It was people with more get and go. It was the non-smokers who were much more likely to leave. At the end of 40 years of emigration from Glasgow and a city halving in size, it has the lowest life expectancy in all of Western Europe. And that was migration, it's selective migration. You might say it's the behaviour of those who left. But why did people smoke and drink as much in Glasgow? It's because they were left in Shettleston and other places where, you know, because they weren't the one who could get out. And you see the opposite effect where people arrive. And this is a big thing for explaining geographical differences in health in Britain. So, I will shut up. If we take everybody who died in the British Hazard Panel study and we put them back to where they were born a day before they died, we actually wipe out the north-south divide in health. And that finding's now been replicated about 20 times.
That's interesting. I'm from Milton Keynes.
Which is a land of migrants.
Exactly. That's why I'm coming to it, because because England's made these longer lives quintile of clustering 50 world authorities by measured by IMD score.
Yeah.
And Milton Keynes has got is in the seventh decile of affluence, so it's a fairly affluent area.
Yeah.
But the average life expectancy is actually just under the national average. So it's always that you're not doing as well as expected, just measured by the simple index IMD.
Yeah.
My idea is there is a cohort effect here of immigration that actually doesn't make it so simple, that correlation.
Yeah.
Is that sort of the similar effect as you're describing in London? A cohort effect. These people come unhealthy in Milton Keynes because they are born somewhere else.
Yeah. You partly carry the health of where you were born with. The classic would be the smog of London. You never escape that as a child, even when you move somewhere else. But also, you're very different from the person who didn't make that migrant move. Migrants are special everywhere, because of the effort of migrating. And this does have effect. And also very sedentary populations are special. So there are parts of the Welsh Valleys where there are families who just stayed and haven't left. And there's awful health in those areas. And it may well be connected to the families. But it's a geographical thing to do with health that turns out to be fairly important. And then the more movement you have, the bigger the differences you get between areas. And then when things settle down and you get less movement, then the divides reduce. So in the 1930s, we had mass population movement down to the south of England in search of jobs. And the north looked really bad in terms of health, but that's partly because the young had moved down to try to find work here. Is that okay?
Okay, anyone else? Brilliant. Thank you very much for this fascinating
insight.